I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, millions of eyes will be on Indianapolis this weekend as it hosts the Super Bowl for the first time. We'll check in with the city's mayor to see how the preparations are going for the big game. But first, we wanted to start the program today by talking about an issue that is challenging the country, the number of young people who drop out of high school without obtaining a degree. According to the Department of Education, one in every four students who starts a public high school fails to graduate on time or at all. And individual states have a wide range of success, with Wisconsin graduating 9 out of 10 students, while Nevada manages to graduate just under 6 in 10, or 56%. In his State of the Union address last week, President Obama offered one solution to address this issue. Here it is.
When students are not allowed to drop out, they do better. So tonight, I am proposing that every state, requires that all students stay in high school until they graduate or turn 18.
But would changing the law make a difference? And how are educators getting a grasp on this issue? We wanted to take a closer look at just why students do drop out of high school and what can be done to keep them on the path to graduation. So today, we're going to focus on Washington, D.C., which has one of the lowest graduation rates in the country. Joining us to tell us more is Kavitha Cardoza. She is a reporter at NPR member station WAMU, and she's been covering D.C.'s dropout crisis for its American Graduate series. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Rashida Harris. She is one of the students being featured in the WAMU series. Rashida Harris dropped out of school 3 years ago. She's since returned to a new high school, and she's here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Also, welcome to you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
So, Kavitha, let's start by talking about the numbers. Only 62% of students in Washington, D.C. are actually graduating on time, according to the federal statistics, but D.C. has a very different number on this.
D.C. says it's closer to 76%.
So I wanted to ask, is there a big difference in how this rate is measured, and does that matter?
It does. D.C. has been using a method that researchers call generous, and the new method, which states are required to follow now, will track every single student. So if a student transfers out, now D.C. will be required to have paperwork and not just say, oh, that student dropped out. I think it does make a difference, Michelle, because often what isn't counted doesn't end up on paper. If it doesn't end up on paper, then it's as if the problem doesn't even exist. These children are sometimes called America's forgotten children.
Tell us a little bit, if you would, and obviously we're going to hear from Rashida on this, but what are some of the reasons cited for why kids drop out, and why in D.C. is the graduation rate as low as it is?
A lot of times it's factors that are common across the country. There's poverty is a big risk factor and everything that comes along with it. So I don't have lights. I didn't have an alarm to wake me up. I'm homeless. Learning disabilities. A lot of times young people say they dropped out because they don't see a connection between what they're learning and what they want to be in life. Very often it's there's not a single adult in their life who cares enough to keep them in school. It's violence, crime, drugs, all those factors play a part.
Well, let's dig into some of those. Rashida, why don't you tell us, if you wouldn't mind, why you dropped out of school? Was it a sudden decision? Was it kind of a spur-of-the-moment thing, or was it something that had been building for a while?
Well, school wasn't really that much important to me. Where I used to live at with my aunt and my brothers and sisters, we had to take care of ourselves. So we would go to school probably 2-3 times a week just to be in school and walk the halls and stuff. Or we would go up to the school if it was a problem as far as gang fights and stuff like that. But school wasn't really that much important to me. The streets was at the time.
And do you mind if I ask, where's your mom in all this?
My mother been dead since 96.
So you lost her really early. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Right, I'm sorry about that. And so your aunt was taking care of you, or you were living with her. She was the adult, but she didn't insist that you go?
Well, at the time, back then, I was with my aunt in the court systems and with my godmother. When I was with my aunt, she didn't really care if we went to school or not. As long as we were out of her house by at least 8:30, she don't care where we was at.
And what about the other things that Kavitha talked about? You didn't see the connection. You didn't see why it mattered?
Sometimes, but I don't know.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Rashida Harris. She dropped out of high school here in Washington, D.C. 3 years ago. She's now back in school. Also with us is Kavitha Cardoza. She reports on education for Washington's WAMU, and she's doing a series on why students drop out and what it would take to get them back in school. What about the teachers, though? I mean, aren't the teachers in the school saying, where are you? Why aren't you here?
A lot of times teachers are really overwhelmed because sometimes, you know, some of the students I've spoken to, they're like in the 11th, 12th grade, Michelle, and they're reading and writing at the second grade level. So you can imagine the amount of just academically the pressure on teachers to just bring them up to maybe even the seventh grade level. A lot of times these children also have so much going on in their lives, they either check out, so they're distracted, they put their heads down, go to sleep. Or sometimes, as in, I'm sure Rashida won't mind me saying, they start arguing with the teacher. So often when they're out of class, the teachers feel, oh, we can concentrate on the students who are here who really want to learn.
Is that true? Rashida, did you do that? Did you get into beefs with the teachers? I see there's a little hint of a smile there.
Somewhat.
Because?
It was just my attitude back then. I didn't care. I felt as though nobody else cared about me, so why should I have to show you respect if you don't show me respect?
What did you interpret as respect?
I see respect is treat someone like you want to be treated. So if you come at me nasty, I'm going to come right back at you nasty.
I have to ask another question, if you don't mind my asking, is what about the safety environment? I've also heard that sometimes kids don't go to school because they are afraid to be there. And I know that's a hard thing to admit, but they just don't feel safe in school, so they look for reasons not to go. Maybe not
It yet. Happened to people I know, but every school that I went to, I was always known as one of the Harris families or by my hood.
So you felt a zone of protection for yourself, so that wasn't your issue. But tell me about this idea of keeping kids in school until they're 18. In Washington, D.C., that is, in fact, is the requirement, that students are, in fact, required to stay in school till they're 18. That's a requirement that President Obama would like to make nationwide. Does that seem to make any difference?
I don't know what it would have been like if you had told children, you know, because that is the requirement now. So I don't know what it would have been like if you had told children, oh, at 16, you could leave. One of the things is I think it's good because we kind of set an expectation that until 18, that is your job. If you do it or not, like if you fall short, that's one thing. But at least as a society, this is what we expect from you. Sometimes, I mean, it's going to be challenging. There's a lot of money going to be involved if these students come back. We're going to have to rethink how we educate these students. Some of them, don't want to be sitting at their grade level. Often teachers are going to have to deal with students who don't want to be there, and that's going to be challenging. Getting parents, or this idea that now parents are not in charge, the federal government or the government is kind of telling you what to do, those are all things that are going to play into it.
So Rashida, we heard that you left, but then you came back. What made you come back?
What made me come back, because I realized how much is very important to receive an education. And nowadays, a high school diploma can't really get you no good job. So I ended up starting doing GED programs on and off, but I never succeeded to it. One side of me said I wanted to do it, the other side of me said I didn't. Until I ended up having my daughter, that would really open it up and made me realize I really want to go back to school. I wanted a high school diploma. I really don't want no GED no more. I want a high school diploma.
So you wanted to do for her, and you also wanted to be, I guess, an example to her. Is that
right?
How old is she now?
She'll be 8 months on Friday.
Oh, happy birthday to her. Congratulations. And how old are you, if you don't mind my asking?
I'm 19.
You're 19 now. What about this idea of saying you have to stay in school till you're 18? Would that have made a difference?
No, because, back then, they told us once you turn 16, we really don't have too much to do with you. 3-4 suspensions, maximum 25 or 45, you kicked out of our school. So they didn't really care about us at the time.
Well, good luck to you. I'm excited for
Thank you.
I'm excited for you. Kavitha, if I could have a final thought from you, what are some of the strategies that seem to be working in Washington, D.C. or in the rest of the country to help students like Rashida get back into school and stay in school until they achieve their goal.
Yes, they are. Rashida is going to a smaller high school. She's got a lot of adults who pay personal attention to her. There are some charter schools in D.C. that are actually, and traditional schools that have career and technical training. So students part of the day have academics, part of the day they learn a trade like construction or something like that, hospitality. They have staggered timings so that students can work late and they can study late, they work during the day. Often there are phone calls and text messages and home visits to say, come to school, re-enroll. Teachers and principals are knocking on doors. So there are a lot of people trying to give these students who have already dropped out a second chance.
Rashida, I should have asked you this. What do you want to do when you finish school? I know you say you're realizing now that high school is just part of it. What's next for you? What do you want to do after that? So we can keep a good thought for you.
Well, my plans was to go to Delaware State or Morgan State and studying criminal justice to become a homicide detective.
A homicide detective. Well, tell me why.
Because it's too many people out here that I know that got killed and their cases haven't been solved. And most officers and detectives, after 4 or 5 years, just sweep the file to the side.
So you want to change that?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to keep a good thought for you. Stay in touch. Let us know how you're doing.
Okay.
Kavitha Cardoza is a senior reporter at member station WAMU. She covers education. Rashida Harris is a student at Luke C. Moore Academy High School in Washington, D.C. They were both here with us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you both so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Tune in tomorrow when we'll continue our conversation on the dropout crisis by talking to a Nevada principal who spends her Saturdays trying to bring dropout students back to school. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, there are changes in Google's privacy policy, and they are causing a stir. We'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about Facebook's new stock offering. That's coming up in a few minutes. But first, we are looking ahead to the big game this Sunday. Don't act like you don't care. Of course, we're talking about the Super Bowl. We are going to head to the host with the most, Indianapolis. Of course, that city is known for putting on the Indy 500 racing competition every year, and it has hosted a lot of high-profile college sporting events, but never a Super Bowl until this Sunday, when Lucas Oil Stadium will be at the center of the sports universe as the New England Patriots and the New York Giants fight for the Lombardi Trophy. The field is not the only place where there is drama. Union supporters marched downtown yesterday to protest a controversial new law signed by Governor Mitch Daniels, and there are other challenges to hosting such a big event. We wondered what they are, so we've called upon the mayor of Indianapolis, Greg Ballard, and he's with us now from NPR member station WFYI in Indianapolis. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Now, you know that the Super Bowl, and no offense, is usually hosted by big party cities like Miami and New Orleans. It's not quite the reputation that Indianapolis has. So what is it about Indianapolis that makes it a good destination for the Super Bowl?
Well, many things, actually. Very hospitable people. You know, we have the term Hoosier hospitality, which is really true. It's not just a phrase. But also, people like our compact downtown. It's the connectivity of it all. A lot of the venues are right next to each other. People can walk from hotel to hotel and then over to Lucas Oil Stadium and over to the convention center and so many other places. A lot of venues, different venues in the area. I think that's what makes it special. The sports journalists who have been coming to our town for a long time understand that. And frankly, for the Super Bowl, we made it even better with a three-block street that we made into a Super Bowl village, which is getting attended by tens of thousands of people, even on weekday nights.
Well, you know, the NFL is calling this the most urban of all Super Bowls. Could you talk a little bit about the kind of manpower and coordination it takes to stage the Super Bowl, which is, of course, not just a one-day event. It is, you know, all week long.
Yeah, we actually made it a 10-day event. We opened up the village last Friday, and we've been working on this for 4 years. When we got the bid, we went to work immediately on it. I formed a committee, which has been very strong for a long time now, and as we get closer to the Super Bowl, the committee started hiring more people, obviously. Public safety is a big aspect of it. Public works is a big aspect of it. And then we have the volunteer base, and we usually have about 4,000 to 5,000 volunteers on standby for anything that may come to our city. This time we thought we had to ramp that up to 8,000. We actually had about 13,000 people sign up, but we're using about 8,000 volunteers who are really literally taking days off of work to come be a part of it.
Well, no, obviously people can envision the whole concept of, you know, street closures and moving a lot of crowds in and out of a compact area. But what is up with the flying manhole covers? What's been going on with the flying manhole covers? What is up with that?
Oh, that's funny. That's, you know, older cities sometimes have, you know, mature infrastructure systems to them. And sometimes that happens occasionally.
Sometimes that happens.
Yeah, it just kind of, you know,
one
pops off
here and
there.
Why are you late for dinner? Well, there was this flying manhole cover.
So it does kind of happen. We had we kind of have a stretch over the last couple of years, maybe four or five, six or something like that. And actually, the Power and Light Company actually put a different manhole cover, certainly in the downtown area, so that it would not release. It would fly up a few inches and then it would release whatever it was trying to release, and then fall back down. So we'll be going out there.
So that's not a good way to try to sneak into the stadium.
No, probably not. But I think most cities have issues like that when they have the older in underground infrastructure.
We're speaking with the mayor of Indianapolis, Greg Ballard. Indianapolis, of course, is hosting the Super Bowl this weekend, and we're talking about what's involved in hosting Super Bowl 46. You know, we were talking earlier, and you were saying that this is, without question, a win for the city. And you were part of the team that tried to lure Super Bowl 46 to the city. You know, there's some data that disputes that. There have been mixed reports about whether host cities actually make money or lose money during these big events. And in fact, there's, you know, this board that actually operates the stadium in Indianapolis that reportedly expects to lose money because of the unique way that the sort of tax revenue from concessions and all of that gets apportioned. So at the end of the day, is it really just in the dollars and cents aspect of it worth it?
You know, there are expenses, and you're talking about the Capital Improvements Board in the city, which runs a lot of these big venues, but a large part of the Capital Improvement Board's job is to put heads into beds and to promote the city along with the Convention and Visitors Association. So it's kind of a combination of things, and you know, we'll see what the tax revenue is. But the direct economic impact of this is estimated between $150 and $400 million. The NFL has a wide range, but we certainly have a lot of people coming down to our city right now to have a lot of fun. So it's going to be a fair chunk of change, I think, that comes into it. But the exposure that we're getting, especially, and I don't know how much you've been tracking the exposure from the national and the international media, but it's extremely positive for the city of Indianapolis right now because of what has been going on, how we've organized it, how we have made sure that it's convenient for everybody, how hospitable we are, and the facilities are first rate. You know, that combination has been giving us a tremendous amount of positive exposure. Well, you know, I'm talking to all these radio stations, probably 10 different cities today alone.
I see.
And they're very, very positive.
So about one thing that perhaps is not so positive. There's always politics going on before, during, and after a big event. Right now, one of the big stories pertaining to Indiana is this whole controversy around the so-called right-to-work rule. Do you expect any... Is this affecting any at all the mood of the city as you prepare for this big event?
No, not overall. There has been, you know, some people surrounding the State House, some protests are surrounding the State House, and as far as I know, that's where it's been right now. You know, they've kind of been through the Super Bowl Village. A few of them have been, but it's been generally positive, and so it really hasn't affected the mood yet. I'm hoping that it doesn't affect the mood. Clearly, our public safety apparatus is in contact with all the different groups that want to protest. They're just like any other Super Bowl would be.
Well, they're a union too, though, aren't they?
Sure they are.
Do you think it affects their morale?
No, I don't think this. I think they're looking out for the city, to be honest with you, and they're doing their job well.
Here's a delicate question. Would it be rude to mention that the Indianapolis Colts, also Super Bowl winners in the past, have not fared quite so well this season?
Not so sensitive a question. No, I've been asked that all day long.
Okay, all right. I'm just kind of easing up to it.
No.
Is it bittersweet to have the Super Bowl in your town at a time like this, especially with a rival like the Patriots?
That's a great point. We've been spoiled here for about 12, 13 years, watching one of the greatest in history in Peyton Manning and the great people surrounding him, like Reggie Wayne and Marvin Harrison, Dwight Freeney, Robert Mathis, Jeff Saturday, all those folks. We had a little rough patch this year, not much question about that. But if you have to go through a little rough patch at times, I don't think that overall negates the fact that the franchise is very strong, the city supports the team, and that we're able to put on these huge events, frankly, as a result of the Colts being such a strong franchise.
So I was too polite to mention that they were 2-14 in the regular season. So
oh, yeah, you got us the number one pick.
Okay. Always looking on the bright side, are you?
That's, yeah.
So who are you rooting for?
Well, I've been asked that a lot, and I'd rather not be asked that, but I'll be frank with you. Most, you know, this is a Manning town. I think people most understand that. And,
so the Giants, Patriots. Because Peyton, yeah. Your quarterback, Peyton Manning's younger brother, yeah. Eli, I don't want to say little brother because he's too big to be little.
He's pretty big little brother,
he's pretty
yeah.
big to
yeah.
be little. Okay, so we meet him on a corner, but yeah. Eli Manning is obviously doing a great job for the Giants, so you're with the Giants.
Yes, well, and we want to be hospitable to the Patriots, too, but they are kind of the arch rival, and this town leans a little bit toward the Mannings.
And, Mr. Mayor, this is also always an important question for Super Bowl Sunday. Wings or chili?
Oh, wow. I'd always do wings. I'd do wings.
So. Okay. Not even a question. Didn't even have to think yeah. about it. Gregory
right.
Ballard is the mayor of the city of Indianapolis, which is, of course, hosting the Super Bowl 46, that's kicking off this Sunday. And he was kind enough to take time out of a really busy time to join us from Indianapolis. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Mr. Mayor. Good luck.
A real pleasure. Thank you so much.
We're going to head now from the site of the Super Bowl to some of the world's biggest websites. Big changes are in store at Google and Facebook. Facebook is the world's largest social media site, and the company filed for its initial public offering, or IPO, yesterday. It is hoping to raise $5 billion through the sale of stock to the public. At the same time, Facebook is catching flack for its timeline format. The timeline takes all of your postings and photos, like that embarrassing picture from the kegger in 2006, and makes them easily available for you and other users to see. On the other hand, critics are raising concerns about changes to Google's privacy policy. The new policy lets Google share user information with its other services like YouTube, Gmail, and the Google search engine. Here to explain what all of this could mean for you is Cecilia Kang. She is a national technology reporter for The Washington Post, and she's with us from the newsroom there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Could we just start with the news about Facebook? Why does this IPO, this initial public offering, this first sale of stock to the public, why is it creating so much excitement?
Well, it's creating so much excitement because everybody knows how dominant Facebook has become, how it's become sort of the social network of choice. I think it has about 90% of all users, social media users. 845 million users around the globe are using Facebook. So everybody knew that there's a lot of value in this company. So it became really sort of the most anticipated business event that people had been looking for quite some time.
Is there enough growth potential in Facebook to warrant this price tag?
It's a great question. The thing about this stock offering is that, you know, Wall Street is unforgiving in some ways, and they want continued growth. And Facebook's growth is still on a trajectory, but it's slowing. And so Facebook, that's going to be a big question. How will Facebook make money, particularly over mobile devices? Because as of now, they aren't making money off of ads on mobile devices. But at the same time, it is, again, the most dominant social network on the internet. And that means that if an advertiser wants to get their message across, that's the company that you want to go to, the website, Facebook, because you're going to have the most bang for your buck, reach the most users globally by approaching Facebook. So yes, there's a lot of excitement, but growth is going to be a big question going forward.
But the very dominance of the company is exactly what raises concerns about the next thing I want to talk to you about, which is the timeline. Tell us how it works and why so many people are so concerned about this.
Sure. You know, the timeline basically is Facebook's way to take all the information that you've given the website, from your photos to the videos you posted to status updates to clicking that little like button saying that you like a particular fan page or like a comment made by a friend or family member, and putting that all into what they would call sort of a scrapbook. The thing is, some users feel like it just, you know, that the company is putting together their information in a way that's a little bit more revealing. Of course, it's not that more people will see it, but it kind of just puts everything out there in a different sort of format that feels a little bit more bearing in some ways. And it's another example of a company, including Google as well, that is taking information in for some users, many users actually, are using their information, using consumer information in a way that users may not want to be used, that they never gave permission in the first place to be used. And they feel sort of out of control. Users are feeling a little out of control with what they've given these websites.
Well, we're speaking with Cecilia Kung, national technology reporter for The Washington Post. We're talking about big news involving media giants Facebook and Google. So obviously we want to talk about what's going on with Google, but just one more question on the Facebook question. What does the company say about that when users are expressing concern about that? What do they say?
Sure. Facebook says, listen, we're not changing your privacy settings, meaning if you said you only want to share your photos with just particular friends, we're not going to change that at all. We're just changing the way it looks, the way that how much is out there on the front page, the photos we put up there. We're making this more of a digital scrapbook than it is sort of a news feed, the way that it's displayed now. All we're doing is changing the look. We're not changing how many people can see it. So, you know, that is definitely something that Facebook has in its defense. That said, sometimes the way things look can feel a little bit more revealing than some people feel comfortable with.
Sure. So let's switch gears now and talk about an issue that really is about privacy, at least as far as the users are concerned. Google says, the change, this is how I understand it. You can tell me if I'm right or wrong.
Sure.
As you wrote in a piece last week, it'll allow the company to stitch together a fuller portrait of users, but some members of Congress are so concerned about this that they've asked to meet with Google CEO Larry Page. So tell us more about this. What's your assessment of this?
Sure. I think the biggest question is why the company decided not to let users say, no, thank you. I'm not so interested in combining my Gmail information with my Picasa information so that you can target ads in a different way toward me. I think that's the biggest question, is that why there isn't an opt out, an option to say, no, thank you, I don't want this to happen. That's what members of Congress are concerned about, and they want to know a little bit more about. They're not necessarily collecting more information. What they're doing, as you just said, is combining data across your services. As long as you're signed in, what they can do is, for example, if you're signed into Gmail, see that, oh, actually, at the same time, you're searching for this on the search engine and watching a particular video clip. So now I know that on YouTube, you like Tony Hawk skateboarding videos. And on the search engine, you have looked for skateboard prices. So now, next time I might recommend a skateboard show in LA or something of that sort. So it's stitching together a more complete picture, as you said, of a person, their likes, their habits, their dislikes.
You know, there's been a lot of division in sort of tech blogging world about this. On the one hand, some people are saying, well, that's just common sense. I mean, that's just the sort of a logical evolution of how this information gets used. Other people are saying, you know what, there's not enough security now. There are still people hacking in, finding out, wiping out people's databases, wiping out their personal information, that this just isn't warranted. And again, why can't people opt out? So, Cecilia, I have to ask again, what does the company say about this? Why can't people opt out?
Sure. The company says that it wouldn't be – they wouldn't be able to provide great, tailored, customized services without everybody doing this at once. Why do it halfway? Let's go full force on this. So they say that there isn't an opt-out provision, and they say that this is better for its users. And there is division as to whether this is good or not. So, I mean, behavior ads, I would love it if somebody could tell me that something's for sale for something that I would actually like to buy as opposed to something that's not even in – on my radar. And so getting my demographic data and, you know, my behavioral, you know, habits, some data on that, in some ways, it's not such a bad idea, some users would say.
Okay.
But
I think, I'm sorry, Cecilia, we're out of time, but something tells me we're going to be talking about this again. So please keep us posted. Cecilia Kung is a national technology reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us from the studio at The Washington Post. Cecilia, thank you so much for keeping us up to date.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a minute, we'll hear what kind of music Oscar nominee Viola Davis likes to listen to. That's coming up. But first, it's time for our Wisdom Watch conversation. That's the part of the program where we speak with those who have made a difference through their work. And today, we want to talk with somebody who has made a difference in how we work it.
You better work.
You may recognize that as RuPaul's 1992 dance hit Supermodel. Ever since then, RuPaul has been acclaimed as an entertainer, singer, and model. He is known for his glamorous dresses, sky-high wigs, and even higher heels. Now, at age 51, he hosts his own modeling competition for drag queens. RuPaul's Drag Race on the Logo Network opened its fourth season last week, and the episode scored the highest ratings of any premiere in Logo history. And RuPaul joins us now to talk about his work and his life and whatever else is on his mind. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And RuPaul really is your name.
Yes, my real name.
RuPaul André Charles, if I have that right.
Yes, yes. My folks are from southern Louisiana, so I have a Creole background. And the roux is literally is the roux in a gumbo, the gravy that you make before you make a gumbo.
And your mom said, you say in your bio that your mom gave you that name because she knew that you would be a star.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Why did she think that?
I don't know. You know, she was very intuitive, and, you know, people from that part of the country claim to be very intuitive, and I believe them. So I grew up with that, and I knew that I would be. I didn't know I'd be doing drag, that's for sure.
How did you get into drag?
Well, I was in a punk rock band in Atlanta, Georgia, and we were, this is the Reagan 80s, and we were into trying to sort of push the envelope. And somebody suggests we do a gig in drag, because it's really, in our culture, the last taboo for boys. And we did it. And the reaction I got was outrageous. So I thought, interesting. I'll take note of that.
Why do you think that is? Is it in part because you're so tall?
I think there are several reasons. And in hindsight, you know, I come from a family of all girls, and my features are somewhat softer than usual guy features. And you know what? I think it's beshared. I think it's kismet, honestly.
Did it bother you, though, that you have in your bio that you were mistaken for a girl at a young age? And I was wondering, did that used to bother you until you figured out how to work it? Work for you.
Well, you know what? It didn't bother me because I knew that people say all kinds of things and people really aren't that bright. Okay, there, I said it, you know. And I learned that from an early age, too. Early age, I thought, okay, I didn't fit in. I'm going to figure out how to fit in. So once I figured out what people were doing and what society was doing, I realized, I don't want to fit into that. I want to stay on the outside of that.
You do, though, say in your memoir, it was not easy. This is not an easy thing. A number of other performers, though, who have an unconventional path to success have also had a difficult time of it. Like, for example, Tyler Perry talks about how, you know, he lived in his car for a time. You went through some really difficult periods like that.
Sure. But I think it's difficult even if you don't choose to follow your bliss. It's difficult if you choose to do what other people want you to do. Life is not easy. And I, you know, it's a pet peeve with me with, you know, a culture where we want to make the world baby safe for kids. It's like, well, you know, kiddo, you can't make it baby safe because we've set it up to where suffering and pain is a part of life, and that's okay because there's a way to override that.
Which is what?
Which is to go within and to understand that you are not your body, you are not your circumstances. You can transcend every situation, even, believe it or not, death. And many people have come to this planet to tell you that. You can transcend any of it because it's really all a dream. I don't want to freak people out with this stuff, but hey, that's what's going on here.
Well, but it's interesting because it's a tough message from somebody whose performance aura is associated with beauty and lightness and fun and fizz. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I do know what you mean. But really, the overall commentary on what I'm doing is saying, hey, look, I get to create whatever persona I want to. And it's all up to me. And the truth is, we're all basically the universe pretending to be humans for a brief moment in time with a little self-induced amnesia.
I'm speaking with legendary performer RuPaul. He is a model, singer, entertainer. We're checking in with him for a Wisdom Watch conversation. He's dropping some knowledge on us even as we speak. You know, talking about the fact that you're saying, look, we're all born naked and we're all in drag. We're talking now a lot more than we used to about the transgender experience. You know, people who feel they were born in the wrong body. But that's not you.
No, not at all. Not at all. I have, like, you know, people have issue with my stance on that because the truth is, You know, people take themselves too seriously. I think, yeah, okay, you're born in the wrong body. But the truth is, you're not your body. So why take it so seriously, you know? And you know, if it causes you pain, you know, do whatever you want to do. I'm not going to stand in your way. But I don't think it's that serious.
The drag is a performance art. I mean, you identify as a man. You don't see yourself as being other than a man or trapped in your male body or whatever. But the whole drag aura, the wigs, the heels, the fabulous dresses are a performance for you.
Yeah, it's so funny. I answer this question all the time. I don't understand why people have such a problem with it. I know, actually, I do understand why people have a problem.
I don't know that they have a problem with it.
No, it's not a problem. It's understanding the concept. It's mm-hmm. because the ego mind wants you to believe that you are all the things it says on your driver's license or your birth certificate. And so someone who decides, well, I'm going to use all the colors in the crayon box, has to sort of be understood, when the truth is we're all doing that. And I think drag comes up against opposition because drag queens break the fourth wall. We're basically saying, you are not who you think you are. You're actually much more than that. You know, you follow?
I do. Do you feel that there is more or less tolerance for men who like to dress as women, for whatever reason, or for women who like to dress as men? You remember Lady Gaga, for one of the big awards mm-hmm. shows, dressed as kind of her alter ego. What did she? I forget what she called it. Joe, somebody. But she dressed and she stayed in character for the whole evening. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about your perception of how that works.
Well, we are a culture who is obsessed with masculine behavior. For a man to dress in what's considered girls' clothes or whatever, that's definitely looked down upon. But for a woman to do it, it's completely different. You know, I've had talk show hosts ask me, so why are you wearing women's clothes? And they, of course, are dressed in slacks, a blazer, and, you know, a button-down shirt. And people don't get it. And the truth is, we're all doing it. But we have a judgment against what's considered feminine or weak.
Curious, though, about RuPaul's Drag Race, because you were quoted a couple of years ago saying that you did not want to do a reality show because you thought they would be demeaning and it would... Demeaning was the word? Did I have the word right?
Well, no. During the Bush administration, there was a hostility toward anyone who was thought outside the box. So there was a certain hostility. And I didn't want to do it if it was going to be mean-spirited or if it was going to be, you know, sort of talked down. But times change and a window of opportunity opened, and that's when we were able to do this TV show. In fact, when I first hit in 92, 93, you know, Clinton was gotten to office, and there was a window of openness. And what's strange about that is how quickly these windows close.
Interesting. You want to play a short clip just so we can hear for people who haven't had a chance to hear the show? Here it is.
Wigs will fly.
Better. Get out.
Shade will be thrown.
Go back to Party City where you belong.
Words will be mispronounced.
We have to make a post-apocalyptic outfit, and I don't know what that means.
This January.
Well, I don't know. I mean, so what do you think? I mean, do you feel, are you opening the window or... What are you doing?
Definitely opening the window. I think there are a lot of people, we're in about 30 countries around the world with this TV show, who are getting an opportunity to find out about a world that they had no idea. And it's not just, sexual deviation. It has to do with using all of the materials that this planet has to offer and opening up and finding areas in your consciousness that need to be open. I love in yoga, my teacher says, you know, find those sticky spots and make space in there. I think that's such a great vision.
Do you envision a time, if you and I were to get together, however long, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20, when a little boy who wanted to wear a dress to school could do it and it wouldn't be big? Wouldn't be huge.
I think there will be a time when that's possible, but I can't believe in my lifetime how we've regressed in certain areas of our consciousness. So I think there will be a time, probably soon, but I think that those, like I said, those windows close very quickly.
Do you ever get tired of dressing up?
No, I don't. I enjoy doing the television show. It's tough doing my nightclub act, which I'm actually going to go back to this year. I hadn't done it in 2 years. It's tough on the road doing it because, you know, because I need so much time and, you know, and I want to look perfect. There's, you know, on the TV show, we get to control the atmosphere. But now with everybody with their iPhones and their phones in nightclubs, you get all these unflattering pictures everywhere. So that becomes a problem. And I am 51 years old.
Do you ever want to change your look? I mean, that signature platinum wig and the fabulous, you've got the most beautiful lips, of course, ever. And the big eyelashes and the, do you ever want to change your look?
Well, I do change my
brunette,
look. You know, those are
redhead.
Those are the skills that pay the bills right there. But, you know, that's not my only look in my life. My show business career is what I do for a living, but I have so much more life outside of that. And I change my look all the time. But the signature look, you know, it's like asking Coca-Cola, you're going to change the formula? I don't think so.
Yes, sir. Well put. Well, as we said, it's really been a pleasure speaking with you, and I appreciate it. And we call this segment the Wisdom Watch, where we do ask, do you have some wisdom? And and you can direct that to whomever you wish. I mean, it could be a young you. It could be a young person listening to our conversation who maybe isn't sure where he or she fits in, or just somebody who's just got the creative flair.
Absolutely. And this is my daily mantra, sometimes minute by minute mantra, which is love yourself, learn to love yourself and stay in this moment. This moment right here is where your power is. If you drift into the past or into the future, you lose your power and your ability to love yourself. So this moment right now, be kind and love yourself.
RuPaul is a legendary entertainer. His program, RuPaul's Drag Race, is in its fourth season on the Logo Channel, and he was kind enough to join us from NPR New York. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'd like to end the program today with a feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we ask some of our guests to tell us about the music that keeps them going. Today, we get the personal playlist of Oscar-nominated actress Viola Davis. She joined us back in the summer to talk about her role in the film The Help. Davis has already won top actress honors at the Screen Actors Guild Awards for that performance. Now we'll hear about the musical performers who inspire her.
My name is Viola Davis, and I'm starring in The Help. And I'm currently listening to Mary J. Blige's song that she wrote especially for the movie The Help, called The Living Proof.
It's gonna be a long, long journey. It's gonna be an uphill climb.
I personally love this song because it's a song of inspiration and it's empowering. It was a song especially written for my character in The Help.
I'm so glad the worst is over, because it almost took me out. I can start living now. Oh, I feel like I can do it.
Oh. And I'm also listening to I Can't Make You Love Me by Tank.
Turn down the lights, turn down the bed, turn down these voices.
It's kind of a rendition of the Bonnie Raitt song.
Tell me no lies, just hold me close.
And I just love it because it's a different version of a song that I loved when Bonnie Raitt sang it, and I love when he sings it and gives it that kind of male energy. It kind of transforms it into something else.
And I will give up this fight.
And I'm also listening to Otis by Kanye West and Jay-Z.
If
I invented sweat. Popping bottles, putting supermodels in a cab. Proof. I guess I got my swagger back. Truth. New watch alert. New blows.
It's a hip hop song dedicated to Otis Redding. So it's a mixture of R&B and hip hop. I love it.
Niggas talking real reckless, stuck man. I adopted these niggas, put them drumming in. Now I'm about to make them tuck their whole summer in.
That was Oscar nominee Viola Davis telling us what's playing in her ear. And to hear our previous conversation with her, please go to our website. Go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More.
I'm about to call a paparazzi on myself. Live from the Mercer. Run up on Yeezy the wrong way, I might murk it. Flee in the G450, I might surface. Political refugee asylum can be purchased.
And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bracton Booker, Bridget DeShagas, John Ketchum, Lauren Megaki, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Amitha Parasha, and Amy Ta. Our intern is Bridget Armstrong. Our editors are Alicia Montgomery and Ahmad Omar, with help this week from Lori Grant. Our special thanks to NPR's librarians. Our directors this week are Arjun Hutchins and Emily Oxenschlager. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. The technical director is Neil Tevolt. Our special thanks this week to Sean Fox, Sean Phillips, and Kevin Langley for their help in Detroit. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. The senior supervising producer is Carlene Watson. Our executive producer is Tashima Walker. And remember, to tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.